Thought Press Network.
Welcome to Morbid Curiosity, a podcast about
the darker side of life.
We are not licensed professionals. We are not therapists. We are not psychologists. We are not doctors. We are not lawyers. What we are two insanely curious people.
This podcast occasionally contains strong language, unusual humor, which may be unsuitable for children, and some adults. This podcast is intended for mature audiences only.
If you find any of these things offensive, please stop listening right now, and you can join us on any of our other podcasts.
What is life? I don't know. What is death? And I don't know that either. I've been asking the question this week, if my heart stops and my lungs stop, am I not, in essence, at least partially dead?
You can tell a little bit by my
demeanor.
Yeah, or hesitance, that this for me is not a very comfortable topic.
We knew that going into this podcast, there was going to be topics that may disturb one of us more than the other.
Yeah.
Even though we are both
morbid as hell.
Right. And that we watch a lot of stuff and can talk about a lot of things. But there are certain things that hit a nerve that maybe you didn't even expect to hit a nerve until you started doing the research, and then you realize, whoa, this is heavy for me.
Exactly. Because that's a big question people have. Like, am I afraid of death? Do you fear death? Do you fear dying?
I do, actually. I have feared death for a long time. It's always this thing, this nagging thing in the back of my head. I always feared I'd die in a car crash, I was gonna die and nobody was gonna be around to be there when it happens. And then the older I get, the more I fear it. And so the more cautious I am about certain things I want to do. Not that it's stopped me 100% from my adventurous type of personality, but I drive at the speed limit. I'm really afraid of dying by a car accident. Like, that is a thing. And I think it has to do with the fact that we live in Miami.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of car deaths.
It's the number one city.
Yeah. And I lost a lot of friends to either car accidents or motorcycle accidents or some sort of vehicular death.
Which is why you won't let me get a motorcycle.
I won't let anybody that I am close to mm-hmm. get a motorcycle. I will personally make it my agenda to wake up early every morning and pop those $400 tires till you finally say, forget it. I have spent money enough in tires to buy a new bike.
No, I remember when I mentioned that I had always wanted one, and you said, nope, I can't. And you told me why. And I said, well, okay, out of respect for my friend, I guess I'll buy a toy one.
I lost a dear friend of mine on a motorcycle. I rode it once.
Mm-hmm.
It was my own personal promise to him when he passed that I would try to see what he loved so much about motorcycles, that I would ride one
mm-hmm.
so that I could in some way feel that rush that he felt. I rode it the one time, never got back on a bike again. Won't do it.
See, this is then where what I was, you know, we discuss the episodes every
yeah.
so often. There's a lot of things that we don't show each other.
Correct.
Surprise each other or learn
right.
from one another about what we find. Death, you can approach it in a way that's detached. The physiological death. The process of how a body dies.
Let's start at the beginning of the end.
We already personified it by giving the title
Death and All of His Friends.
You should know where the title comes from.
No.
Okay, two places. Grey's Anatomy used it for, of course, one of
it's
their
episodes. It's a song by Coldplay. Oh, you are right.
And I was like, how did it...
It did pass right by me. But it's also because I have a tendency of fixating on specific Coldplay songs. I know what album now that you said that. Like, I know exactly what album that was on.
Yes, if I hear Clocks one more time.
That's not my only favorite song. You can listen to anything on the X and Y album, and that album I will play until I'm dead. I will play that album. I will always
play.
Then
I know what to play at your funeral.
X and Y.
our friends are going to hate us so much for this episode because we will be talking about
our own
end.
Yeah, our own end. Did you look into the process of dying?
Of course I did.
Of course.
Of course.
Now, what is it that you found with regards to the basic process of dying?
Signs of death. Respiratory arrest, no breathing. Cardiac arrest, no pulse.
What happened, Hunt? Speak to me.
Talk to me.
Hello.
Hi, where are you?
We sent an ambulance right away.
Okay, what's your name?
I looked down the sidewalk and I thought I saw a pile of clothes on the ground. And as I came closer, I realized it was my husband. He was lying there with his mouth open and his eyes wide open. I was looking at the face of death.
Bill Bonder has just become another victim of cardiac arrest. With no heartbeat and no breathing, Bill is clinically dead. There's no more oxygen reaching his brain, and the cell's machinery goes into panic mode. If he doesn't get oxygen within minutes, their furious struggle to survive will turn them into a toxic wasteland. They send signals. This is the beginning of the end. The cells will soon self-destruct.
Pallor mortis. Pallor meaning pale or whitish. Paleness that is usually between 15 and 120 minutes after said death, after the body dies.
Within about 2 hours after death, the blood slowly sinks to the lower regions of the body. This stage is called liver mortis.
This causes a purplish, reddish kind of discoloration, which when I've gone to, unfortunately, wakes, I would always wonder, why are they kind of black and blue? And that happens between 20, 30 minutes, but it can't be observed by the human eye until after about 2 hours.
Right.
So the blood settling in the lower portion already starts shifting and changing the color of the skin. And that's, you know, it looks bruised. It looks brownish.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have algor mortis, which is the reduction in body temperature following death. It's generally a steady decline until it matches about the ambient room temperature. Rigor mortis.
Which we know, but for those who don't.
Rigor mortis is one of the recognizable signs of death, caused by chemical changes in the muscles after death, causing the limbs of the corpse to stiffen. Rigor mortis can occur as soon as 30 minutes after death. After death, respiration in organism ceases, depleting the corpse of oxygen used in the making of adenosine triphosphate, ATP. When oxygen is no longer present, the body may continue to produce ATP via anaerobic glycolysis. ATP is required to cause separation of the cross bridges during relaxation. Additionally, calcium enters the cytosol after death. Calcium is released into the cytosol due to the deterioration of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Also, additional calcium enters the cytosol from the extracellular fluid due to the breakdown of the sarcolemma. The calcium activates the formation of myosin-actin cross-bridging. Once calcium is introduced into the cytosol, it binds to the troponin of thin filaments, which causes the troponin-tropomyosin complex to change shape and allow the myosin heads to bind to the active sites of actin proteins. In rigor mortis, myosin heads continue binding with the active sites of actin proteins via adenosine diphosphate, ADP, and the muscle is unable to relax until further enzyme activity degrades the complex. Normal relaxation would occur by replacing ADP with ATP, which would destabilize the myosin-actin bond and break the cross bridge. However, as it is absent, there must be a breakdown of muscle tissue by enzymes, endogenous or bacterial, during decomposition.
And then we have decomposition, which is the reduction into simpler forms of matter.
So what happens right after you die is all the fluids that are inside your cells when you're alive leak out, and bacteria start feeding immediately. and they're converting the liquids and solids inside you into gases that they emit. And this causes the second stage, which is bloat. You also have something called marbling during this stage because one of the gases, sulfur, it binds to the hemoglobin molecules in your blood and changes the color of them to an orange or yellow. Then after a few days of that, the body moves to the third stage, which is called purge. And that's ultimately the bloating is relieved as a lot of the gas and fluids leak out. You see this dark fluid pooling around the body. And the interesting thing is that fluid, it's really nutrient rich, but it's so rich in nitrogen that it kills off the plants initially. But a year later, it'll become especially fertile. A lot of the changes happen really rapidly at first, and then it slows down a lot.
So that's the process of death.
I'm sure that physicians have a specific order of things. Coroners, they, you know, there's a specific order. I've read so much of it, but again, like I said, it just started to get a little bit overwhelming,
right?
Reading about it, because it's inevitable.
But the truth is that ultimately, whether we see it or not, this happens. Unless you get cremated, it's going to happen to you. I mean, that's what ecosystems evolved to do, is harvest nutrients to create new life.
The process of dying is, I think, well, we're in process.
We are already in process, but there are certain things that people have started to notice. I read on a hospice website, when you're dealing with an elderly person in hospice, that they will say things like, there will be moments of clarity where you will see that. And that is usually towards the bottom end of the process of dying, this surge of clarity, mm-hmm. where they will be talking about things that they maybe have never spoken about. You always have that. You hear stories of people asking for specific people and like holding on until that moment. Then you have the last breath, which there's a term for it. It's that last gasping of air.
Shortly after recording, I looked up the sound that Q was referring to, and the term is the death rattle, which happens upon the final moments of one's life. I decided to omit the actual sound file that I heard from this episode because I guarantee you it is disturbing. Out of respect for our listeners, I would rather omit it and leave it to your curiosity than to play a file that might change or affect what death means to you. Thank you. And now back to Death and All His Friends.
Before we get into the different mortis processes, mm-hmm. That I thought was rather interesting that we've started to pick up on that. And I think that I didn't really realize its truth until I saw it in my own grandmother, who had suffered from Alzheimer's and dementia. And then that moment of clarity came, and it was one of those, like, most people go, it's a sign of getting better, when it's not always that's the case. It's actually a sign of what I can only assume, and this is going to go me into a mental part of it all, is your brain saying goodbye. Your brain saying, okay, I'm going to let go of all of this that I have inside because I know that this is coming.
Yeah, it's like coming back for a moment and saying, hey.
Yeah, hey.
I haven't forgotten you totally.
Yes, this is what's going on. And then you go. So that's rather interesting to me. Even the whole hospice thing, you guys will hear a nurse that we were able to interview who actually worked in hospice. And I think that nurses who work in hospice, anybody who works in hospice, is really doing, for lack of a better term, a level of God's work, in the sense that you are doing a job knowing that all of your patients, for the majority of the part, some people do make it out of hospice, will see their end under your care, and you're there for it.
Remember in the last episode, we talked about criminals and people who are doing life in prison. They started setting up a hospice program.
Correct.
Basically humanizing others for them, and they come to terms with what death really means as opposed to I just killed someone. No, this person has died. We're talking about the word death, you know, and we use it in anything. I'm dying to have a pizza. I'm dying for this. I'm dying for this. If we break down the meaning of the word death, we know it's a noun. We know that. Yeah. Okay. It's the action or fact of dying or being killed. The end of the life of a person or an organism. It's the state of being dead. The permanent ending of vital processes in a cell or tissue. So what we were talking about are vital processes. Heartbeat, done. Brain death, done. In all of its essence, it is the ending of something. Physically, we stop.
Right. If we're not going to get into the afterlife, then yes, physically, we stop. And therefore, physically, we have died. It's a really interesting thing. I think originally when we thought about doing the episode on death, it came from a sadly humorous conversation about death. We started talking because I had a legitimate question about what happens when cemeteries fill up.
You said what happens when there's no more room?
When there's no more room and we continue to die and we continue to overpopulate. And I've never seen a lot cleared out to become a cemetery in my 32 years of life. They've just always been there and they've bought enough land that once they start to get filled, then they start chopping off trees and making a little bit more space.
It's layers. They build up and up and up and up. I'm sure death literally has a lot of friends.
Which is a little disturbing for me. For one, it is disturbing. But before we get into the burial and the cemetery stuff, but that's really where this started. It started from like I just wanted to know what ends up happening and all of that other stuff. But before we even get into that and having to do with your process, I had always had an obsession with the idea of the 21 gram theory.
Yes, I've been dying to hear what it is that you've come up with. And I've stayed away from it on purpose.
Fantastic. So it is a theory. This isn't anything. And this is going to come down to your individual beliefs. And all of our beliefs sometimes change, you know. But the theory was, and there's a movie out there called 21 Grams. And it's got Benicio del Toro and Sean Penn. And it's a good movie. It's called 21 Grams. Doesn't go into it as much as one would think. This isn't a movie about death, so to speak. But they do talk about the 21 gram theory. And they do explain that what the concept is, the theory is, that when you die, the body loses almost exactly 21 grams of weight. Some say that that is what your soul weighs. That your soul weighs 21 grams.
How many lives do we live? How many times do we die? They say we all lose 21 grams at the exact moment of our death. Everyone. Fits into 21 grams. How much is lost? When do we lose 21 grams? Five nickels, the weight of a hummingbird. a chocolate bar. How much did 21 grams weigh?
So that is the releasing of one's soul from the body, and that is somewhat the finality of death. While you have all of these processes that happen, depending on your belief system, when the soul leaves the body, that is when that person has officially died. I looked it up, and again, it's a theory, so you may or may not agree with it, but basically, this is kind of how it goes. In April of 1901, an unusual experiment was conducted in Massachusetts by a doctor named Dr. Duncan McDougall. He wanted to know, and he wanted to prove, how much the human soul weighed, that it was measurable. Dr. McDougall conducted this experiment on 6 dying patients who were placed on specially made weight scales just prior to their death. His intention was to weigh each body before and after death to determine any differences measured by the delicate scales. The patients were selected based upon their imminent death. 2 patients were suffering from tuberculosis, 5 were men, and 1 was a woman.
Once the patient died, an interesting event occurred. McDougall explains.
Suddenly, coincident with death, the beam end dropped with an audible stroke, hitting against the lower limiting bar and remaining there with no rebound. The loss was ascertained to be 3/4 of an ounce.
What caused this weight loss? Everything was taken into account, from the air in the lungs to bodily fluids. It still could not be explained. The experiment continued on the next patient with the same results. Dr. McDougall felt he was onto something extraordinary. According to Dr. McDougall,
the instant life ceased, the opposite scale pan fell with a suddenness that was astonishing, as if something had been suddenly lifted from the body. Immediately, all the usual deductions were made for physical loss of weight, and it was discovered that there was still a full ounce of weight unaccounted for.
Following the experiment and consulting with the other attending physicians, it was determined that the average weight loss of each person was 3/4 of an ounce. Dr. McDougall concluded that the human soul weighed 21 grams.
What he was able to figure out through much trial and tribulation was that indeed, for the majority of it, every time he would weigh them right after death, within a few minutes. So we're talking about probably the second process here.
Either pallor or livor, which is when the blood settles.
That is when those ounces are lost, that weight is lost, 21 grams. He conducted this experiment also in dogs and in rats. They lose no weight.
I am not going to get into the death of pets. I'm saying it right now. Humans lose something that no other animals have.
We're talking 1901.
Yeah, when they thought that blood could drive you crazy.
You know, there's a lot of things that are going on. So this led, the thing with the animals led Dr. McDougall to conclude that dogs didn't have souls. And that souls were significant to only humans, which as pet owners, we don't believe in that, but that's just what they thought of at the same time. Now, they did take in his study, I do have here, what about the consistent weight loss? And apparently everything was taken into account, from the air in the lungs to bodily fluids, and it still couldn't be explained. An interesting variation occurred on the third patient, who maintained his same weight immediately upon death. But after 1 minute, he lost about 1 ounce of weight.
I believe that in this case, that of a phlegmatic man, slow of thought and action, that the soul remained suspended in the body after death, during the minute that elapsed before its freedom. There is no other way of accounting for it, and it is what might be expected to happen in a man of the subject's temperament.
So he attributed it to the person's personality, or where they might have been at mentally, that why it didn't happen so quickly or within the same time frame in which all of these other patients had lost the weight.
This is, again, during the time of one of my favorite topics, which is the humors.
Right.
And studying the levels of blood, where they thought that that's where your personality lies in, the phlegmatic, sanguine, et cetera, et cetera. Are you saying, or is this article saying that he also theorized that maybe it was a loss of their character or personality?
No, he was attributing how long the weight took to be lost, attributed to personality and characteristic.
So if he's stubborn, it might have taken a longer time.
Basically.
That's, wow, that's, okay.
Now, again, this is 1901 that this is happening, but he wasn't the only doctor that did this. He, like I said, had four other doctors with him that would each take their own measurements and then compare. And it's not always 21 grams. 21 grams is the majority, which is why we go by 21 gram theory. Some are just very few ounces. Some, it takes longer, it takes shorter, but it amounts to that.
That's where I start thinking, now that I've read the mortis levels, it makes me think, well, if the blood settles in a lower region of the body, settling means to me that maybe a little bit of mass, I don't know, it's like the potato chip theory, you know? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's filled, the bag is filled with air, but there's a lot less potato chips than you think.
I would have actually assumed that the body would have gotten heavier
because
upon death. Because of the settling of fluids, a drop of blood, and this is my theory, I haven't tested this out or anything like that, but I would assume that a drop of blood will weigh this amount, and maybe once it starts to thicken and coagulate, that maybe it's heavier, maybe by half an ounce. But I would have assumed that even with a stiff body and your body going into rigor mortis, that you would actually weigh more. Maybe not by a lot. Maybe weigh more by 21 grams. I'm not really sure, because there's a lot of things that go into death. You have the release of fluids that happen.
The release of air.
The release oxygen. Of air. Of the release of oxygen when you have that last breath that eventually does get released. You have a lot of things that go. But then you also have the idea of he was dead weight, right? And when we talk about dead weight, it's usually that something is extremely heavier than it would have normally been.
Yeah, that's like when people say, you know, he went dead in my arms or...
And it's like dead weight.
Yes.
So that's kind of another idea that I had in retrospect to the opposite of the 21 gram theory, where I would have thought that something would have been heavier.
What is the actual difference between a living creature and a dead body anyway? To understand what death is, we need to understand what life is. One ancient theory was an idea called vitalism, which claimed that living things were unique because they were filled with a special substance or energy that was the essence of life. Whether it was called chi, lifeblood, or humors, the belief in such an essence was common throughout the world and still persists in the stories of creatures who can somehow drain life from others or some form of magical sources that can replenish it. Vitalism began to fade in the Western world following the Scientific Revolution in the 17th century. René Descartes advanced the notion that the human body was essentially no different from any other machine, brought to life by a divinely created soul located in the brain's pineal gland. And in 1907, Dr. Duncan MacDougall even claimed that the soul had mass, weighing patients immediately before and after death in an attempt to prove it. Though his experiments were discredited, much like the rest of vitalism, traces of his theory still come up in popular culture. But where do all these discredited theories leave us? What we now know is that life is not contained in some magical substance or spark, but within the ongoing biological processes themselves.
I know that I'm going to cover that a lot more when we get into autopsies and when we do that episode.
You love autopsies.
I have a weird fascination.
It's morbid.
No, it is. We but can I say mean, that. It's what I love about it is how after you die, you still have stories to tell. your body does. Your body has a story to tell. So you have some renowned pathologists who have been able to go on the stand and be able to use that in a defense or in a prosecution against a criminal because that person is no longer alive to tell what happened to them. And I guess that my fascination with autopsies has to do with my fascination with the justice system and court cases and things like that, because when you've had a murder and you've got people telling you 500 different stories, it's important to know, well, what does the body say?
Which is interesting that you say that, because in livor mortis, this is usually what forensic investigators tend to use to determine whether or not the body has been moved. Like, depending on where that bluish coloring of the skin.
Right.
If the body has been turned, lifted. And I always wondered, I was like, what is it that when you would tell me to watch these shows, what is it that tells you the body's been moved?
It's the settling of the blood. If you got shot, weren't moved, and you fell and you landed on your back, that's where the collection of all of those fluids would happen. And so you would have all of that bruising and discoloration on your back. But if you were moved and now it's on your side, or now it's different, just like bruises come out later.
Yes.
You know, and that comes after death, you see the bruising, which is why for me, autopsies are extremely important. I'm a firm believer in autopsies for everything. You know, there are some who don't believe in them when it's just when they don't want to know how somebody died. They just don't want to know. And I have too much of a curious mind to not know.
You mean in this case, an unnatural death as opposed to...
Not a murder. I'm talking about somebody who died in their sleep, and maybe you don't want an autopsy. I would want one. I would want to know what it was. What was it? You know, did they have a heart attack in their sleep? Did they suffer from not breathing, you know, and not having known that they had some sort of sleep apnea and that's what killed them? You know, I'm always curious to know. Unexpected deaths, I would always be curious to know. I'm the kind of person that would want an autopsy if I go unexpectedly do one, because I'm pretty sure in my afterlife I would be curious to know what it was. I would want to know.
It's interesting that you're interested in that aspect of it. For me, it's what the body looks like if they don't choose, let's say, cremation or closed casket, what it looks like after death, that you go to a funeral and you see the body in that coffin and you think to yourself, that does not look like the person at all.
Did you look up by any chance when we started to have open casket funerals?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because after this documentary that I saw, Death and Dying, and an embalmer was talking about how she makes up the bodies, this is when I sent you the message, I am done. I am done with this, because it was overwhelming.
I have a serious problem with open casket funerals because they never look the same. It is the last time that you're going to see that person, and you are going to be left with an image that is nowhere near close to what that person was, that picture you had of that person in your head. And I don't blame that on the funeral homes. The makeup artists, for me, for the most part, do the best job that they can. But what your body goes through after death, they can't control the swelling.
The drying.
They can't control what that looked like and what they're working with. And so I've unfortunately had many really bad wakes that I've gone to. None of them have ever looked the same. Some of these funeral home workers did not do a good job.
No, when they try to make them grin, I've seen funerals where it looks like they tried to. I was like, what were you thinking?
I try to strike a balance between what they look like normally on an everyday basis and what they would look like if they were dressing up for an important function. I think for your funeral, you should look like you were going to a wedding. When someone's being embalmed, they're laying on a table, and gravity is pulling at their features. It's pulling the corners of their mouth out So a lot of times what I like to do is fill those corners in with a little bit of wax and cosmetize over that wax with the same color as their base to sort of shorten their mouth a little bit, which creates a more natural appearance and remedies that drawn out look that seems to happen after embalming.
Yeah, no, for me it was the non-removal of blood in the head region of a friend of mine who passed that it was still on him.
Mm.
You mean you couldn't see that? Like, I could see that. How did you not see that and remove that and clean that?
And if you couldn't, tell the family, listen, it needs to be a closed casket.
You know, and that for me was really disturbing. And I was okay with it. I kind of knew what was going to happen going into it. I unfortunately, the first time I lost somebody, I was really young and I wasn't actually allowed to go to the funeral, which is when my grandfather passed because I was 9 and my parents felt that I was too young for that.
I think Latin culture.
We're a little bit more hesitant in the realization, even though Disney movies killed that for all of us.
That's another topic. The morbidity of Disney is, it has to be an episode.
But when I was finally old enough, I lost my aunt and I was about 16. And I remember walking into the funeral home, walking right up to the casket. I looked down for what I feel like was a millisecond, and I walked right out. And I told my mom I was going home. And I was 16.
But it was your first time.
It was my first time.
Yeah.
And I needed to get the heck out of there, and I needed to leave. And not that they did a bad job. In retrospect, that first one that I went to go see probably looked the closest to what that person actually looked like, than what happened in every other funeral that I went to afterwards. I was finally, through age, able to sit through more funerals and be there. And the older you get, the more you have to stick around because of the person who it is that passed away. You feel that pull.
It's not uncommon for an embalmer to embalm someone that they know or a member of their family. That's one thing that we can do for that person. That's the skill that we know. That's how we can serve them at that time. The first thing I do is grooming. And that includes cleaning under their fingernails, shaping their fingernails, tweezing any hair. I'm always very focused on what I'm doing and doing it properly and correctly. So when I'm working, I'm really focused on a very small area.
Funerals are just a really weird thing for me. I think that having this open casket, and everybody has so many different types of funerals. I've been to funerals where it's a party and people are throwing things into the casket that, you know, a pack of cigarettes here, take a beer with you to your afterlife and so on and so forth. And then you have the new thing that people are doing where they're sitting the bodies up.
That's in itself, I mean, it's a form of human taxidermy. It was a viral post on the internet that, where was it, in Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico.
That they propped up the man who had passed, dressed as he's usually dressed, and sitting in a position. Was it on a couch?
He was in a
or a lounge chair.
Like a lounge chair.
Okay, and sitting as if they were just visiting him.
Right.
And that was one of the things that also prompted me to really get into this episode. Like, the decisions that one makes when preparing the body for viewing, because there's people that they need to see it.
Yeah, and again, it comes down to everybody's different. I personally don't believe in the open casket thing. It is, for me, enough that I know what has happened. I know who is in that casket, but I feel that isn't how you should see one for the last time. And I'll leave it at that. I just don't think that is a very good picture to have. And it's such a hard one to remove from your brain once you've seen it. It's not the kind of thing that you're like, oh, I'll get over it.
You don't forget it.
You don't forget it. And then so every comparison that you have later on kind of leads you back to that
moment.
Yeah.
It's easier to not necessarily dehumanize them, but distance myself from the emotional side of the fact that they've died. I was 16 or 17. I had just gotten my driver's license. We had a neighbor that passed away very young and very tragically. We were both so emotional. I remember viewing the person and thinking to myself, no, that doesn't look like her. It doesn't look like I remember her. You know, I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could maybe even do better. Finally, I do cosmetics. The cosmetic process basically starts by identifying any dark areas. If the dark areas on their hands, I like to use a spray cosmetic, essentially a flesh-colored spray paint. On the face, I'd like to use a cream cosmetic, and I use a special brush called a stipple brush, which recreates the look of pores.
I would see their chest more puffed out. I remember seeing it was my great-grandfather when he was in the coffin. And I remember his size, how thin he was. But seeing him there, it was as if they stuffed him with newspapers. I hate to say it like that, but that's how it feels to
me. You know, I'm glad that you said it that way, because I was about to say it and not realize how crass it might have sounded. But you have to take into consideration that when by the time that the body has gotten to the wake part of this whole entire process of dying and death itself, it's been opened, it's been autopsied. Maybe that person was an organ donor, in which case these organs were removed and they were stuffed with something else. That is a thing that happens in different situations. You also have to take into consideration different countries. We here are a little bit more advanced in with regards to certain aspects. In other places, they are stuffed with newspapers.
In different cultures, I mean, remember the Egyptians, how they would adorn the people that have passed. The pharaohs would be buried with all kinds of gold mummies.
Well, all of their assets would go with them. Here, we have wills where we give all of our assets away at death. And you're talking about the Egyptians, where you were buried with all of your treasures. You were buried with the things that they thought you were going to enjoy, which I guess feeds into the putting things in the casket that you are going to then go with. In a weird turn of time, it is our own Egyptian-like thing that we're doing, that we're leaving them with something that they're going to use or they're going to appreciate in whatever afterlife you believe in. I think that that also depends on whether or not you believe in the afterlife, if you believe in heaven, if you believe in any of those things, or if you don't. And I think that death is scarier for those who don't know what they believe in.
I agree with you 100%. If you don't know what happens to the soul, it becomes that much more frightening, because then death is stopping.
Death is the end.
And what then? Whose right. point of view is being looked at? You know, like, have you considered that you see life out of your point of view as if you're the camera in a movie?
Correct.
Okay. So once that stops,
yes.
is the movie's over.
The movie's over. The story is over.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, but what happens after? Something has to come next.
Well, really all that comes, well, it depends. I mean, if you believe in nothing, if you are an atheist, or if you are a believer of something that isn't heaven or reincarnation or anything like that, really your movie stops. Somebody else just turns on their camera.
It fades to black.
The world death rate is holding steady at 100%. The Onion is a satirical journal, so it's their job to make fun of us as we try to hide from mortality. What would happen if we turned toward loss instead of running from it? What if grief has something to teach us? In 2008, my husband and best friend died. Vic was my harbor and safety net. So what did I learn from that loss? To answer that question, I have to go way back to my first childhood memory. I was small. I stood near my mother, who was lying face down on a wooden bench. Her eyes were hidden in her hands, but I could tell she was crying because her back was heaving up and down. Her sobs scared me, but I didn't call out to her. Instead, I was captivated by rays of colored light coming from above, dancing off the walls and filling the space. Soft color covered my mother's back, my little arms, everything. I didn't understand the experience then, and I don't understand it conceptually now, but I felt protected by that light. And even as a child, I knew my mother couldn't feel the protection because her face was turned away from it. I learned as an adult that I'd been under 3 when that happened. My father was in a Catholic hospital, and he was expected to die. My mother had taken me with her to the hospital chapel, so the light came from stained glass windows, and the wooden bench was a pew. Knowing the facts about the experience didn't change its power. I trusted that support was available during grief if I looked for it. My father didn't die at the time. He lived 11 more years, always ill. After his death, when I was 14, my mother felt completely unsupported and was afraid she would drown in grief. So she retreated. She went to work, came home, and went into her bedroom. Although she loved my father, she didn't weep for him, and she didn't speak about him, and didn't want me to speak about him either. While he was lost to death, she was lost to life. When I returned to school, no one mentioned what had happened to me. And after we buried my dad, the family never returned to the cemetery. Of course, I felt distant from my mother and isolated from everyone. My father's empty chair at the dining room table left a huge hole in my heart. 8 years ago, after months of a lingering flu, an oncologist told my husband, Vic, "You likely have lymphoma. I don't know what kind." Vic and I sat in our car in the parking lot, stunned by this news. "Let's not tell anyone," Vic said. "Maybe it'll be nothing. We don't want to worry people over nothing." I took that in, and I turned to him, and I said, "Vic, I don't want to do this alone the way my mother did. I need our sons and our friends. I need all the support I can get. I think you do too." We agreed, but I saw how tempting it is to hide our grief wounds and try to go it alone. Vic died after 2 tough years. A friend took this photo just a few hours before his death. After that last exhalation, there was no inhalation. The end. I was numb and exhausted, but this time I faced grief rather than running from it. I knew it could be my teacher, and I turned where humans have always turned in times of challenging transition. I turned to ritual. It's human to create meaningful ritual. Anthropologists know they've discovered civilization when they find signs of ritual at ancient burial sites. We ritualize weddings and baby showers, baptisms and funerals. We create rites of passage to connect our worldly and our sacred life, to move us from where we are to where we must go. I needed to move from the safety of my marriage through a vast ocean of grief to find the woman I am on my own. Personal ritual helped me make that journey. I knew I needed to accept that Vic's soul had left his body. Now, I'd been there for his last breath, but there's something surreal about death for those of us who aren't around it much. Modern people keep a distance from death and hand it over to hospitals and morticians. We don't wash bodies and lay them out at home the way people did just 100 years ago. Vic died soon after midnight. Friends and I sat with him until morning light. Then I washed his body with warm water and my tears. And I helped shroud him, wrapping and tucking as though he were a baby. I helped put his body in a body bag, and I watched as a young man wheeled him down the hallway toward the hospital morgue. I needed to let him go. I knew that wouldn't be a fast process. It would take a long time, but I could at least set the intention. So the day after his death, I went with a good friend and my oldest son to the crematorium where Vic's body was being held, or to the funeral home until his body was being held for cremation. We lined the cremation box with white soft blanket, and we put photographs of his students, his teachers, his friends, and his family in the box. We surrounded him with flowers and written prayers. Because it's important to stay awake in the after-death experience in many traditions, we put coffee beans in his cremation box, and it made us laugh and weep. And we also put bittersweet chocolate in there and a box of his favorite shape of pasta. I didn't think he'd be hungry. It was symbolic the way ritual is. I didn't even know if it mattered to him, but it mattered to me. Picture this. My son put two hawk feathers behind his dad's ears, and we covered it with another soft blanket, closed the lid of the cremation box, and wrote a prayer on top. We had created a traveling cocoon. I knew it would help if I had a sacred place to soothe my grief. Vic had asked to have his ashes put near his favorite red oak tree in our forest, so I thought we'd just scatter them there. But my sons had a much better idea. They dragged large shale and granite stones out of our creek bed to the site, and they dug a shallow hole. I walked out to the woods carrying a small cardboard box I'd received from the crematorium. I opened it for the first time and pulled out a plastic bag of about 1.5 quarts of rough ash the color of yellowed teeth. "Is that all that's left?" my youngest son yelled. "What a ripoff!" And we all started laughing. Vic would have loved that joke. We put his ashes in the earth and we built a cairn on top. And then we sang songs and said prayers and recited favorite poems. And we told many stories about Vic that made us weep, and even more stories that made us laugh. There had been a private memorial service. I'm sorry, there had been a community memorial service just a few days after his death. But this small private family ritual a few months later gave me a sacred place surrounded by natural beauty. I still, 6 years later, I still walk to the cairn under the red oak tree with the intention of leaving a little sorrow behind. I want to leave you with three things I've learned from loss. I am not in charge. Of course, I never was. But when I stood at the threshold of death, I felt something vast and unknowable, so far beyond my ordinary sense of self. Opening to that mystery was humbling. It made me a little wiser and a little more realistic about our precarious human situation. Love and grief are a package deal. Think of a movie or a song or a book that really sticks with you. Chances are it's about love and also about sorrow. Love ends in loss for the ones left behind. And grief is a natural response to losing what we've cherished. When I pause to remember someone I've lost, grief is right there, but so is love. Ritual soothes and heals more than I ever could have imagined. When I couldn't stand my heartache one more minute, I took my grief for a walk in nature and visited the cairn under the red oak tree. I often left flowers there. I usually left tears. I always felt better. You likely already create personal ritual in your life, even if you don't call it that. At a recent bereavement group, a woman told me, "I have a photo of my husband in my bedroom and I put flowers there. And recently I put his cell phone there. And I'm embarrassed to say it made me feel better." You created a personal ritual, I told her. Cell phones contain our personal history, and it turns out many people in the bereavement group were attached to their spouse's cell phones. Cell phones have voices, photographs, calendars, contacts. They're a perfect modern memento. A funeral ritual marks the beginning of the grieving process. But grief doesn't last just a few days. We can keep creating personal rituals for ourselves as long as we want to, as long as they help us. Three grieving mothers in Atlanta created the Atlanta Walk to Remember to honor their three infants who had died. 10 years later, hundreds of people walk with them to remember lost children, so a small personal ritual became a healing community ritual. I committed to writing every day after Vic was diagnosed with cancer because I wanted to remember what was happening to us. After his death, I continued writing because my daily practice had become a healing personal ritual. Years later, my journals led to articles, blogs, and eventually a book. So my small personal ritual led me to a whole new life as a writer. Humans create ritual spontaneously and naturally. Our rituals can be as small as a 30-second pause to remember someone we've lost, or as elaborate as a Hollywood funeral. In shared ritual, we dare to show our grief wounds to each other, even if it's our habit to hide them. Grief opens our hearts, binds us together, and makes us grateful for each other. Through ritual, our grief becomes entwined in love. Grief is a wound, but it's also an opportunity. As the 13th century poet Rilke says, the wound is the place where the light enters you.
Please stay tuned for the next episode of Morbid Curiosity, Death and All His Friends, where we discuss...
How do I know that that's really them in there? That was my first initial thought. Like, how do I know that what you gave me is supposed to be the person who I love and this person whom I've lost?
This is where it gets hard.
So come over, just be patient, and don't worry.
For more information about Morbid Curiosity, visit us on www.morbidpod.com. You can also find us on Facebook at the Morbid Curiosity Podcast. Please follow us at Morbid Pod on Instagram and Twitter. Next week, Part 2 of Death and All His Friends.